Francis will be back next Thursday at 3:30 with another edition of Interval. It's 3.5 minutes after 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. It's my great pleasure to welcome back for a return visit to Fresh Air Eric Barnow, who is America's leading scholar of broadcast history. His new book, The Magician and the Cinema, is about the period of time where movies and magic intersect. Before there were movie theaters, there were magic theaters where audiences were promised the performance of astounding feats like self-decapitation and the conjuring of ghosts. The special effects mechanisms used to project these images were borrowed and improved on by the filmmakers. The magicians feared they'd be put out of business by movies. The Magician in the Cinema has just been published by the Oxford University Press. Barnow's earlier books include his trilogy, A History of Broadcasting in the United States. It's a staple for anybody interested in the history of broadcasting. One of his recent books is about the role and influence of the sponsor in broadcasting, and it's called The Sponsor, Notes on a Modern Potentate. After we talk about The Magician and the Cinema, we'll be talking about some current broadcasting issues. Last month, Eric Barnow retired from his position as chief of the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Eric Barnow, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you
here. Very glad to be here.
You know, until I found out about and then read your book on The Magician and the Cinema, I really had no idea about how the two met. And I wonder if everybody else knew about it, if I was just left out in the dark, or if you've discovered something that we weren't aware of.
That's a very common reaction, very common. And part of the reason is that this material that goes into this book is from the literature of magic rather than the literature of film. The magicians plunged into cinema early. They were involved in the inventing of cinema, the prehistory of cinema, and in the early days of cinema. And they developed the trick film, special effects, and so forth. But the tragedy for magicians was that this was a terrible mistake on their part. They soon discovered that the tricks that they used to do on the stage and that astounded everybody, and which they then began to transfer to film, that anybody could do them on film. You didn't have to be a magician to decapitate people or to change a man into a skeleton, etc. Anybody with a camera and a splicer could do that. So in a way, they had undermined their own profession. There were heaps and heaps of films suddenly about decapitations, trick films of all kinds, people transformed into skeletons and back. There was a whole rash of them. They were called trick films, and they were first done by magicians and then by a lot of other people. Now, not only did this become stale, but those same things no longer had the impact on the stage that they had had. Now, the magician, as of 1895, just before the arrival of the motion picture, the magician was the king of entertainment. There were these theaters in London, Paris, and many other places that showed nothing but magic. There was one in Paris, the Théâtre Robert Houdin, that showed magic continuously for 80 years, day, afternoon and evening. And there was one in London also, the Egyptian Hall. So they were great figures, and a lot of the astounding things they did in those theaters were optical illusions done with magic lanterns and things like that. And so when the motion picture came along, when this invention was demonstrated, they just simply saw it as a continuation, the next step to what they were already doing. And they seized on it right away. They bought the equipment, and within months, they were showing it as part of a magic act all over the world. Now, in most countries of the world, I think, I haven't added it up that way, but in many major countries, the first glimpse that people had of a motion picture was as part of a magic act. This is true in South Africa, it's true in Australia, it's true in Ceylon, and so on. And they accepted it as magic, because here you suddenly saw a little screen, and there was the Maharaja walking across it, or the king, or the empress, etc., and they knew that the Maharaja had no business being on a wall like that, so they accepted it as an optical illusion. Now we look at that on the television set, and we think of it as a natural way of looking, monitoring the world. But people, audiences at that time, immediately accepted it as magic. Now, as soon as they got accustomed to it, they did not. So there was this interesting moment of transition. Now, the magicians advertised this as an astounding feat of magic.
Well, I'd like to know more about what the magic shows were like, because now if you see a magic show, you'll probably be treated to, these are maybe the tackier shows, but, you know, the magician accompanied by the young, attractive woman, you know, who brings the hat and brings the magic wand and the whole bit. And but you have wonderful posters in your book of things that I had no idea were part of magic acts.
They all had attractive women with them, and
the
women usually had French names,
like Cherie,
Mademoiselle Dalton, and things like that. There was always a variety of things. That is to say, at Egyptian Hall, you might see some of them were dexterity things like. Masculine did plate spinning. That was something he had done, plate spinning acts. So there were mind reading acts, and then there were they had automatons. That is, they had robots who could invite people on the stage, and the robot would draw a picture of them, a silhouette. Or the robot would challenge somebody from the audience to a game of whist or something, and win the game, or chess or something like that. And they had robots that did all kinds of things. Robert Houdin did this, and then they had chalk talks. But there were also spectacular events that were built into stories, like Méliès used. He would have. For instance, a journey to the bottom of the sea, and it was done with a number of magic lanterns. He had a trip to the North Pole, for example, and he had stories from the Arabian Nights. These always had astounding effects. And they were in a theater in London, where the motion picture was first shown. There was a booth from which they could project as many as 12 magic lanterns simultaneously. And one of the first of the British filmmakers, as a child, sat with his father, who operated the equipment there. And he said he learned a lot from that. Now, you see, that was just one step away from motion picture. And those magic lanterns had attachment to them so that you could actually get changes within a scene. For instance, you would shoot a scene, and you would move a little lever, and then snow would start to fall, or it would change from night into day, or from summer into winter, and so on. So there were slides that had movable parts on them.
And this was all like rear screen projection, so you wouldn't see the
lantern? Earlier it was rear screen projection. At that time it was not rear screen projection earlier. Now the magician got involved. Let me go back for a minute. The magician first began to make spectacular use of the magic lantern in the 1790s. When a Belgian called Robert, who for some reason called himself Robertson, maybe it was more glamorous to be an Englishman than be a friend, I don't know. But anyway, Robertson began to put on some shows in Paris in the 1790s, in which, with rear projection, he projected onto smoke in a dark room the images of people who had died in the French Revolution, leaders like Danton, Robespierre, and so on. And the images were on slides, so they were silent. They were still. They were motionless. But being projected onto smoke in a dark room from the rear, from a source you couldn't see, the smoke gave them a weird kind of unearthly movement. And people fell on their knees and crossed themselves and really thought they were in the presence of the supernatural. And this was called phantasmagoria. And was such an extraordinary success that shows called Phantasmagoria cropped up all over the world, including New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, etc. And they were all based on the idea of projecting onto smoke from a hidden position. And there was a museum in Boston that burnt down after one of these exhibitions.
Because of all the smoke?
No, because... needed the smoke was made by throwing some chemicals onto a brazier with burning coals, and I guess somebody knocked it over or something like that.
Hmm.
But the phantasmagoria shows were from about 1800 to 1820 or 30. A constant feature in American cities. And the effects of that sort went on into this century. Thurston used that effect in some cases. So they were very familiar with the tricky use of magic lantern. People didn't know that there was such a thing as a magic lantern involved in it. You didn't know the magic lantern as such until it began to be used visibly in lectures by lecturers. But that was the later part in the century, you see.
We know how Houdini tried to expose people who said they were holding seances and reviving spirits of the past. Was there anyone who was dedicated to, like, debunking shows like Phantasmagoria and going around and finding out what kind of special effects equipment was used for The Conjuring?
Well, the people who were doing the Phantasmagoria didn't claim to have supernatural power. They generally said they were scientists. They were busy. There were also mediums who used the same equipment, you see, and the same device, and the magicians liked to expose them. So the exposing by magicians of media involved this and other devices, and this went on all through the century, sure.
So then, like now, people know that there's a technique to magic, but you, in a way, don't want to know the technique, even though you're
right.
Really curious.
Now, you will have noticed in the book some of those posters, like Carl Hertz's poster, etc., that he is always claiming that these are apparent miracles, and he's always claiming that it is his extraordinary scientific skill that makes these effects.
One of the posters is about witnessing self-decapitation, and I think one of them he's going to decapitate his wife also, so there's this headless figure with two hands held out at about shoulder length with
a final bow headless, and his own head is in one hand and his wife's head is in the other. That's right, yeah. It was a gruesome little final.
how do they do that?
Well, of course, the headless effects are done in various ways. I think that that particular one, he doesn't say in his memoirs how he did it, but I'm pretty sure this was one of the things that used black velvet. That is, with the right kind of lighting, you cannot see black velvet. And people could walk around with a black hood over their heads. And in fact, in some acts, they had assistants on the stage who were completely dressed in black velvet. And with the proper lighting, you just couldn't see them at all. So, and I think this is a black velvet case. But the other poster is not, and I'm not sure how that was done.
You said before that some people had been aware of the connection between Méliès and the magicians, but I think most people are not aware of that. So can you tell us about that connection and first, like, spell out who he was and his importance
to film? Well, there are a couple of French film historians who have spent some time on the fact that there are a number of magicians who are involved in the early days of film. And also there's a museum in Britain that has some catalogs that have pinpointed this thing. I myself, when I was in high school at the age of 14, I was hired by a magician to catalog his collection of books on magic, and that was John Mulholland, and his collection was, he told me at that time, the second largest private collection of books on magic in the world. His friend Houdini had the largest collection, and Houdini was very rich and could buy anything, but Mulholland was not. He was more a struggling... Mulholland became secretary of the Society of American Magicians, and Houdini was president. And for a whole winter, I went down every Saturday and spent my Saturday morning making out cards for his books. So then later on, years later, when I became involved in film and was in charge of film studies at Columbia University, I began to be curious about the fact that I was running into names that I had run across long ago in Mulholland's collection. I saw Mulholland periodically, and one day, it was shortly before his death, actually, I said, look, John, is it possible that magicians played a much larger role in the early history of film than is generally supposed? And they said, of course they did. It's a marvelous subject. If you'll come down to my collection, I'll show you a couple of dozen books that have a bearing on that. He died before I could do that, but he gave his collection to the Players Club, and I went down there then and wormed through a number of books that I thought he probably had in mind, the memoirs of magicians who were active at that time. And I found that there were more than I had thought and remembered that there were. And the more I had delved into it, the larger the subject seemed to be. Then when I got to the Library of Congress, there the Houdini collection had come to rest. And Houdini had, there are in the Library of Congress 100 scrapbooks called the Houdini scrapbooks. But they're not really Houdini scrapbooks. What Houdini did is whenever a fellow magician died, he would go to the widow and make her a present of, let's say, $10,000 or so to help her through these difficult times. And then he would suggest that if he had left any scrapbooks or papers or other material of that sort, he would love to have it for his collection. So he acquired the scrapbooks of magicians which take you right back into earlier parts of the 19th century. It's a fascinating business. In his own scrapbooks, he was constantly cutting out anything, any new scientific development, and making little notes for himself on what might be done with this. So all through the 19th century, every new scientific development that came along, magicians saw as an opportunity for a trick. Now, as the public became more familiar with science, the same tricks no longer were possible. I think you probably remember from the book the thing that Robert Houdin did in Algeria. That is to say, France was having trouble with their colony Algeria because some local magicians called the Marabouts or Marabou were stirring up rebellion. And the government asked Robert Houdin to go down there and put on a magic show that would convince them that the French had more powerful magic than these marabouts. And he did this in an astounding way he had a tremendous show, and some of these local magicians were there. And he had his assistants bring on a chest, and they put it on the middle of the stage, and he invited some marabouts to come up and see if they could lift that chest. And they came up and they lifted it with great ease. And then he said, well, now I will, by a gesture or two, take away your powers. And he made some abracadabra and invited them to lift the chest again. And they heaved and pulled and they couldn't absolutely budge it. So after embarrassment, they went back to the audience, and then he had his assistants carry it off. Now, what he had done was, this was in the, I think, 1860s or something, there was a metal bottom to the trunk, and underneath the stage he put a very powerful electromagnet. Now, very few people in an audience would have had any conception that this was possible, could be done, you see. And a few years later, he might not have been able to get away with this because people would have read Scientific American and would know, you see. But this created an enormous effect in Algeria, and had apparently the effect that the French government hoped it would have.
Did Houdini work with film at all?
Did he work with film? Why, sure. He made this. The cover is a Pathé poster for a series, a 15-part serial that he did in the 1910s. A Pathé serial called The Master Mystery. But he apparently made some kind of film for Pathé as early as 1901, which doesn't exist, but there are in one of his scrapbooks still. Now, later on, in the late 10s and early 20s, he made 5 feature films, a couple of which he financed himself, on which he lost a lot of money. And he really hoped to immortalize himself on film, and the climax of each of those films is an escape act of the sort for which he was famous. And he was somehow foolish enough to think that they would mean something on film. This is part of the whole irony of the magician's plunge into film. And on one of those films, you see a subtitle that says, Houdini actually did the amazing things that you see him do. But, you know, Richard Dix could do the same. He could escape from a trunk in the bottom of the ocean and come up and rescue the heroine, and he could do all those things. So you didn't need to be a magician to do those things on film. And Houdini was not as good an actor as Richard Dix. or King Bagot or any of those other people. And he made personal appearances to try to make the films a success, and I think a couple of them were. But in the end, he apparently lost a lot of money on those things.
I want to just reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm talking with Eric Barnow. Now, most of his books have been about broadcasting history. His new book is called The Magician in the Cinema, and it's about how the early filmmakers learned a lot and borrowed a lot from the early magicians who were afraid they were going to be put out of business by the whole thing.
Well, the trouble is they weren't afraid. They discovered they were being put out of business.
They didn't even have time to worry about it.
They plunged into film without realizing that this was a bad strategy for them.
Well, how did it change what they were doing? Did the audiences who were going to the magic shows start going to the films instead?
Well, let's say, let's take this magician Carl Hertz, an American magician from California, who was the first to show a film in South Africa and Australia, created an absolute sensation in Australia with his film. And he made a return visit, and it was clear immediately to him, as he says in his memoirs, that the film part of the program was the part that the audience now liked best. And when he made a return tour a few years later, there were a lot of theaters that had shown booked magic acts, and now they only wanted the film part. See? That's what happened in a very few short years. The story that is told about Carl Hertz's first appearance, his first run in Australia, was there was a sequence in it about it's a scene on one of the bridges in Waterloo Bridge or something in London, and there's a lot of people in it, and suddenly a man looks toward the camera. Now the people in Australia came back again and again to that, and they developed a game of whistling just before that man turns his head, so that the audience had the impression that he was turning his head because they had whistled, you see. So this became a game, and the audience came again and again to play this game with the film. Well, anyway, you can see how that would be a kind of a camp enjoyment. And it was an astounding effect, that's all. But as the stories, as film became more sophisticated, and the magician began to seem old stuff, that's all.
When film was really young, were there a lot of films that were almost about the effects they were capable of achieving, you know, so that they could just amaze audiences with, say, like a train rushing at them?
Yes, yeah. Well, I see. Here, for instance, there was a man called an Italian magician who was famous for his instant transformations. That is, he played a number of characters, and this was partly because he had trick clothing that changed, and but he could change his whole appearance in a second, and he did these little acts in which he played 18 different parts, and he immediately went from one to the other. Now, he made a film of that show, but on film he made his transformations more astounding by stopping the camera and tampering with it. Now, he was suddenly doing something that made it completely unnecessary to have the whole skills that he had developed. Anybody could do it, you see. Now, that was the whole irony of it. Now, he began... Leopoldo Fragoli was his name. He began by filming his acts. He was very famous. Began by filming his acts because there were other magic theaters in other cities to which he could then sell it, and he could make really simultaneous appearances. And Méliès had that same idea. He was continuing while making films. He was continuing to run that magic theater. But he thought, gee, I can help pay my expenses by making films of some of these acts and then sending them around to other theaters and getting additional revenue. And that worked all right, except that other people were also making films. And pretty soon, when Houdini, who had named himself after Houdin, when Houdini came to Paris in 1901, Houdini was dismayed to find that at the Théâtre Robert Houdin, they no longer showed live magic in the evening. They only showed films in the evening, and live magic had been reduced to afternoon showings. So he ought to have had some warning about what the motion picture was doing to the magician.
It's interesting that that's happening, because like when TV came out, people thought it would put radio out of business, and it didn't.
Yeah.
And television was threatening to put movies out of business, and it didn't.
Yeah.
Not yet, well, anyways.
Of course, it hasn't put the magician out of business either. He survives, but he is not the great man he was before. And the kind of... there are no magic theaters that continue that have all this variety of magic one night after the other. There are an occasional magician who puts on these enormous spectacular things with lots of people and women being sawed in half. But mostly, most magicians are now, you know, there's a lot of street magic going on. In Washington, you walk around Georgetown any Saturday night, there are people doing... young men doing magic, and they do it in Central Park in New York, and you know the close-up magic, prestidigitation, legerdemain. But the kind of effects that you did with magic lanterns, those are not done so much anymore.
You close your book by saying that we now accept magical optical illusions as reality.
Yes.
When we go to movies now, the special effects are so incredibly technically advanced, and we all know it's special effects, but I think we're all amazed by it anyways.
Yes, that's true.
What do you think the extent is
of
film being viewed as magic?
But when we're seeing a news program, which is equally an optical illusion, showing us, this is equally an optical illusion, we feel that we're looking at reality. But actually, we're looking at a series of shots from selected points that have been put together with great care, maybe. And the whole thing is an illusion anyway, you see, where the angles have been chosen in such a way as to eliminate what's outside the frame. And so that you're really, whoever is putting together a news program is also... producing something that is not the original thing, but a new construct, you see. And we've lost the feeling entirely. We accept it as the real thing. And we're almost helpless not to accept it as the real thing. But if we were more conscious of it being an optical illusion, we might be a little bit more skeptical. About news programs.
Have magicians and filmmakers expressed a lot of surprise to you about reading this history that they share?
Well, I've had a couple of reactions from magicians who are very enthusiastic, but I know of two magicians who are writing reviews of the book, but I haven't seen the reviews yet. So I'm curious to see what they're going to say.
Okay, if you're interested in reading more about this, the name of Eric Barnard's new book is called The Magician and the Cinema, and it's just been published by the Oxford University Press, and all the posters that we've described are also illustrated within the book. Eric Barnard is a broadcasting historian, and we're going to be spending the remainder of our discussion today talking about broadcast history and about some of the current issues that face broadcasting. And... Well, a couple of months ago, we learned that Procter & Gamble was going to be withdrawing some of their advertising from certain evening programs. And this was after a threatened boycott by the, I believe it was the Coalition for Better Television, which is a group that was objecting to, I think, the way the family was portrayed, objecting to too much sexuality within evening programming. There's a lot of debate now between people who want to put pressure on the television industry for different reasons. Everybody's got got the message that they don't want to get across. But there's been a lot of debate about what the difference is between censorship and citizenship, you know, in broadcasting. Where do you think the appropriate means is to put pressure on broadcasting?
Well, you got a number of questions there. Boycott, of course. Boycotts, I guess, are legal, are they not?
Mm-hmm.
And pressure groups certainly are legal, and some pressure groups I'm very much for, and some I'm not for. And anything that, that becomes a kind of threat, you begin to feel a little uneasy about. On the other hand, I can quite understand that, you know, when a sponsor wants to have whatever goodwill flows from a program, you can understand him withdrawing from a program if he finds that ill will is flowing from it. So I'm not surprised at this happening. Now, this I was at a meeting recently in Hollywood, which involved producers, writers, directors, sponsors, advertising agency people, and a few people from Congress that were all discussing this whole issue. And an awful lot of them, one of the views expressed was, you know, people write letters, people are told to write letters, and you write a letter and nothing happens. Inevitably, you begin to develop a feeling of helplessness, which makes you eventually band together with others in a pressure group. And that's what's happened in this case. Now, practically everybody there felt that there was too much sex and violence in a lot of television, and that this had been used very deliberately because it increased ratings, etc. And a lot of sponsors were perfectly happy with it as long as it increased ratings. But when it not only increased ratings, but increased threats of not buying your product, then they became uneasy. So there's nothing illegal about that has been going on here. I think to compare it with the McCarthy period is just crazy, because there you have a matter of people being barred from roles in broadcasting for political opinions that they had, which had absolutely nothing to do with the program involved. So that's quite a different issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people have charged that this is political in the sense that it's not only sex and violence that's being objected to by some of the groups, but also portrayal, the way women are portrayed, you know, that if they should have traditional models, yeah, and that there should be absolutely no homosexuality portrayed on television programs. So, I mean, that does get into the realm of politics, but it's different than what you're talking about, because it's not people being persecuted for their beliefs outside of the program. It's being charged with what the program's about.
Right. Now, from the point of view of the writer, you get into an absolutely impossible situation when you have to negotiate with a group. That is to say, if the network, as they occasionally have, get into a situation where they allow a pressure group to see a script and begin to negotiate with them about what sorts of changes would make it acceptable, then you have an absolutely impossible situation. Nobody can write a good script under those circumstances. So as a writer, I'm repelled at the notion of tactics of that sort, and but I can understand it happening, you know. And the fact is that a lot of writers have been pushed into injecting action scenes that they didn't really want to, because producer said, you know, the ratings are softening. Let's put a little more action into this.
So the writers really get it from all ends.
Yes, that's right.
Now, some groups, I think, like Action for Children's Television, said that the sponsor is the wrong place to put the pressure on for programming, because they don't make the program; they just sponsor it. And I think maybe I'm misrepresenting them, but I think they'd say you should put pressure on a sponsor for how they advertise and who they advertise to. You know, like they're sometimes concerned about the way advertisers try to communicate with young children about sugary food, for instance.
Right.
But that's different from complaining to them about sex on evening television.
Well, the sponsor is in a position now where he seems to be more withdrawn from influence than he actually is. That is to say, he says, I have nothing to do with it. The network produces a show. On the other hand, the big sponsors buy spots in particular programs. A company like a soap company buys a spectrum of spots, hundreds of them, After very carefully consideration, and a time value is put on each spot. I mean, they say, yes, so many $1,000s for this, so many $1,000s for that, so many $1,000s for this. And they have to do it that way because if that show is canceled, then they have to know how much rebate they're supposed to get. Now, many of them say that they don't want a documentary because it reaches an older audience. They do want this show because it obviously is reaching a young audience. They're selling, let's say, a perfume or a lipstick or something, and they would like that young audience. So they don't say we want that show because it's sexy. They say it reaches the right demographic audience for us. Now. But in effect, they're saying the same thing. In other words, they have by their purchases encouraged the network to produce more and more programs that sell more and more expensive time to companies that are trying to reach that age level. We now are have a situation where the demographic cross the demographic composition of every audience is quickly known through the Nielsen surveys, so that they know that this particular program reaches, let's say, particularly women from 17 to 28, and that's exactly what what the market for their product is. This is a terrible. They are willing to pay so much per thousand women for that kind of an audience. Whereas if it reached another audience, they wouldn't be willing to pay as much for the 30 seconds or for the 60 seconds. So by buying that way, by these demographic things, they actually have encouraged the sexy things without seeming to. Or the violent things without seeming to, because they have said, this is the audience we want, this is the audience we want, and the network has given them that audience, you see. So, in a way, it's inherent in this terrible business of marketing drama by demographics. You know, you're literally in a situation where the networks, in order to make more money, saying, this show is what we want to put in there because it has the right demographics.
You said that you thought a comparison with the McCarthy era was unfair, and that kind of blacklisting is very different than what happened here. How did the momentum get built for the blacklisting in the 50s, and what role did the sponsors play in that?
Let me think back a minute. As early as World War II. I remember some discussion that so-and-so... Oh, well, I tell you, it began to build up. The sponsor got particularly involved in it when this supermarket king from Syracuse... put pressure on sponsors not to hire people who were in red channels. Now, red channels is a book that came out in June of 1950, I think, and listed several hundred people in the broadcasting field who they say were leftish. They didn't say they were communists. They said that they were involved with dubious activities. They had been at a certain meeting and so forth, and they quoted the Daily Worker a lot of those people the majority of those people were not communists, never had been. Actually, the Communist Party at that had been a legal party for many years, so there wasn't anything illegal about what they'd done. But the man from Syracuse somehow made it his crusade. To drive off the air any actor who was in his opinion one of Stalin's little creatures. That's the phrase he used. So he sent a letter, for instance, to the Block Drug Company, The Block Drop Company had a particular toothpaste, a fluoride toothpaste. And he said, I noticed that you have on your program some actors who are listed in this and that book of subversive people. And I tell you what I will do. I will put a sign in my supermarket above your product. I'll put it side by side with Lever Brothers, a similar product. And the Lever Brothers will say, we do not have on our programs any of Stalin's little creatures. And you can explain, I'll let you write a statement that explains why on your programs you do have Stalin's little creatures. Now, I'm not following the exact words, but that's the kind of thing. Now, then he would add to that, I will hold a copy of this letter until I hear from you, and if I don't hear from you in about 2 weeks, I will send copies of this letter to the American Legion and the Daughters of the American Revolution and about 20 other groups, you see. So suddenly the sponsor who gets a letter like this has a nightmare that he's going to suddenly... So immediately he issues to his advertising agency, don't hire these people who are on this list. What is this list now? So suddenly this list becomes a kind of an official list, and advertising agencies suddenly begin to look at this list. Every executive has a copy of it in his drawer. And new lists keep coming out, they came to be consultants, so how to keep sponsors out of trouble. And they kept on digging up new names. It became a thriving industry, naming people who were dubious, advising your sponsors to keep away from them, and so on. Now, that finally backfired when... somebody successfully sued, and that was John Henry Falk, sued the people who were involved in this and won a fantastic settlement, and then the whole thing collapsed overnight. But this was a really slanderous thing, because the people involved were mostly people. Very often they were people who had, during the war, appeared at the request of some relief organization to come and sing for raising relief for, let's say, Loyalist Spain or various other things. And so John Henry Falk actually was listed because he had appeared as an entertainer at a function at which known communists had appeared. Well, The particular thing that was referred to was a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the United Nations. It was as stupid as that. Now, the United Nations, there had been Russians there, various other, and there had been various entertainers, but there also had been the Secretary of State. And a former Secretary of State and a number of other officials, and it was actually CBS that had invited him. Now, this kind of there was a meanness in the charge that was responsible for the whole thing in the first place. It was a venomous thing to do.
When it was starting with this supermarket owner pressuring the sponsors, why do you think that the sponsors gave in? Because they had a lot of power.
He was an official of the Supermarket Association of the United States, and he apparently gave the impression that that supermarkets all over the United States would stop displaying their product. The income from the network depended very heavily on products sold in supermarkets. And the people who sold their products to the supermarkets depend very heavily on the visible display. And if your product isn't there, you're not going to ask for it. So I think that's the terror. Suddenly I'm not going to get the shelf space I need to sell my product.
And then the people within broadcasting had to worry about if they wouldn't have sponsors for their program.
Yes, of course, yes. Yeah.
So do you think that anything similar like that, any similar variations on that theme could happen today?
Well, I suppose they could, yes. Yes, I think they could. I hate to think it's possible, but of course it's possible.
Do you see anything that looks like that happening now, or do you...
No, I don't see an awful lot of like that happening, but I think it could. I'm sure it could.
Okay.
We have these waves we had the Red Scare in the early 1920s when... and then there was a more liberal period, and we have these waves of madness every now and then. It happens in all countries.
I want to reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Eric Barnow, who has written extensively on the history of broadcasting in America. And his newest book is called The Magician in the Cinema, and it's about where magic and movies intersect. There's another new development, this time in public broadcasting, and that's the possibility of an experiment on a few public television and radio stations of adding, on a very restricted basis, commercial advertisements. And I think that that's meant to be a compensation for the cutback in federal fundings for government broadcasting. What effect do you think that would have on broadcasting? I'm really interested to hear your opinion on that. Everybody's talking about it within public radio and television, speculating.
Well, the program choices that are made by the underwriter already are such an important factor in public television that if that situation didn't already exist, I would feel more alarmed about this development. But it is already a semi-commercial system, so I feel less alarmed about it than I would otherwise. We don't have a system. Let's say Britain and Japan have a public system and a commercial system side by side. And in both of those countries, the public system is financed entirely from the license fee, and there are no underwriters at all involved. And both those countries, the public system holds about half the audience half the time. In our country, where we have two systems, one of which is a little bit more commercial than the other, the non-commercial system, operates with much more difficulty and does not hang on to, very seldom gets more than 10% of the audience. So we have a system that is already crippled by a certain amount of commercialism and has no steady source of funds because it's been set up that way. And every Carnegie committee that has examined this problem has said it needs a steady source of funds it can rely on in order to be truly independent. Well, the situation now is that it doesn't look at all likely that they will set up any system whereby it will do that. Probably it will develop in the direction of being another commercial network, because when our present commercial networks, stations, began, they operated just about what we call now non-commercial broadcasting. That is to say, when the NBC president was testifying to Congress back in the late 1920s, soon after NBC had been formed, he made a point of saying, our sponsors do not talk about their products. They don't mention prices or anything. They put their money in these programs simply for the satisfaction that they get out of providing wholesome entertainment. And there's no direct advertising. There's only indirect. Just the goodwill that comes. We let them have the goodwill that comes from mentioning the company. So that's about what we do in so-called non-commercial broadcasting now. So it's a series of small decisions that take you in the direction of a commercial system, and this has gone that same route. And I think it's going to happen because how else are they going to finance it? The commercial is hardly more objectionable than the marathon. You know,
do you think so?
Well, I think so. Yes, continuous and the terrible thing it does to performers, making them spend a whole day begging people to send in money, saying the same thing over and over and over again. I find it repellent. Yes, I do.
When public broadcasting was established in the 1960s, the premise was that it's worthwhile for the government to invest funding in keeping a commercial free system alive, and that it would be important to have information and entertainment that was outside of the marketplace constraints. But that's being challenged in the government now, I think.
Yes.
What do you think? Is it important for a country to have a place like that?
I think it is important for the country to have a non-commercial system that is assured of funds that enable it to do its job without considering whether this is going to result in the loss of a sponsor or not. And to my mind, All Things Considered is by far the best news program on the air. It is far better than anything on commercial television, let's say, in which news has never been favored because it doesn't get as much of an audience. That's a terrible reason for having only a half-hour news program at night, which is only really about 22 minutes of news, and which is scheduled to be, which is a routine to be as popular as possible, so that you have to have a human interest item sort of balanced with this kind of an item. So I would say that all the pressures that exist in commercial broadcasting weaken a news service, and that to have a program like All Things Considered is important. And if it doesn't come from a license fee, it has to come from some other way. Now, the public is paying for all these things. Why the essential services should be routed through an advertiser? I mean, we're really paying for these essential services by paying a commercial company to make it part of his merchandising to provide this service. Now, that's a completely illogical thing. We think we're getting something free. We're actually getting something we're paying for, and we're simply making an advertiser the agent of it, which is, in a way, an illogical thing to do.
Some countries do have license fees. Could you see something like that ever happening here?
No, I don't think so. I think we're already paying more for cable systems than we would have to pay for license fees, so I don't think it's possible.
Do you think the television is about to embark on a really different change, of course, because of the addition of many UHF stations and, of course, because of cable also? Do you think that the history of broadcasting is about to radically change, or do you see it being more of the same?
I think that, there are all these inventions ranging, including optical fiber and satellites and videotape, etc., that have revolutionary implications. But they have revolutionary implications that lead in different directions. That is to say, the implication of the optical fiber is that a single strand of optical fibers could bring everything into your home, television service and everything else. You don't need a lot of different wires. You only need that one. So this creates the possibility of the most extraordinary monopoly we've ever had, you see. So that's revolutionary in that sense. Now, the satellite, similarly, it has to do with distribution. There's nothing about the satellite that encourages a particular kind of production, particular kind of programming. The thing that seems to me to have most revolutionary implications, really, is one that isn't too often thought of in that way, and that is the videotape. Because here suddenly is something that puts into the hands of an artist a medium that is cheap. Eventually, the tape could be as cheap, and not worry an artist any more than the investment in paper worries a writer. And the equipment involved also may not worry him any more than equipment would than buying a typewriter worries a writer. Did you want to interrupt?
Oh, we were running out of time. I just wanted to mention that.
Okay.
So you say the technology is getting more into the hands of people besides the people in the industry, and that will change the future.
I think it may. It creates a number of ways of distributing a thing that a writer has control of.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I've been speaking with Eric Barnow, who is a broadcast historian, and I want to mention some of his books. His book on the history of the sponsor is called The Sponsor, Notes on a Modern Potentate. His new book is called The Magician and the Cinema, and that's just been published by the Oxford University Press. And there's also his very important trilogy on the history of broadcasting in the United States. Well, that about does it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I just want to tell you what's coming up tomorrow afternoon on the show. At 2 o'clock, we're going to rebroadcast an interview with Meinhard Robb, and he was in The Wizard of Oz. He played the Munchkin Mayor. Now, you may know that a film about the Munchkins who were in the making of The Wizard of Oz opens tomorrow, and that film's called Under the Rainbow. So we'll be hearing from Meinhard Robb tomorrow at 2. At 3:30, Bill Van Wert, our film critic, returns from his vacation. And then at 4 o'clock, we'll be talking about travel with two people who have written extensively about travel. So our phone lines will be open for your questions and comments during that time. Maybe you're about to go on a vacation. Contributing today's show was Maeve McGoran and Francis Davis. The technical director today was Rob Richards. The associate producer of the show is Danny Miller, and I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is WUHY-FM Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger with All Things Considered.
Because my name's McElroy, I was his wife. And they don't want no part of us. I mean, they just don't want to do nothing about it because he's a McElroy and I'm a McElroy. But I know what I'm talking about because I was there and I've seen it all.
The town is Skidmore, Missouri, a small community. Everyone knows everyone else. And everyone seems to know what happened 2 weeks ago when Rex McElroy was murdered. But the town has reasons for keeping quiet. The story tonight on All Things Considered.
And these stories, on the day after President Reagan's legislative triumph getting his tax bill passed, a threat of filibuster to fight tax breaks for the oil industry.
Also in the aftermath, accusations of bribery by a political action committee to win votes for the Reagan tax plan.
New administration policies on immigration announced today.
A report from Philadelphia about refugees from Mongolia who are having a difficult time resettling.
In one California county, young people eligible for welfare are being asked to enlist in the army.
New evidence of political repression in Nicaragua.
And new information about the Eisenhower administration's role in a military takeover in Guatemala.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, Richard Harris has this news.
President Reagan flew to Atlanta today, basking in yesterday's tax cut victories and painting a rosy future for America. Mr. Reagan told a conference of state legislators that passage of his 3-year tax cut was the most crucial item of his agenda for prosperity.
America is better off today than she was yesterday. America is more confident today. And the economic possibilities for all Americans are greater than they were 24 hours ago. America now has an economic plan for her future. We know where we're going. We're going forward. We're going onward. And we're going upward. And as I've said before, we're leaving no one behind.
About 300 demonstrators marched outside the hotel where the president spoke. They chanted, "Bread and butter, not jelly beans." Despite the president's optimism, his economic program hasn't passed yet, and Missouri Democrat Richard Bolling, chairman of the House Rules Committee, says he will not allow final approval of the Reagan budget cuts until a provision eliminating minimum Social Security benefits is dropped from the package. Bolling has the support of the House Democratic leadership. Congress is scheduled to recess for the month of August, but Bolling says he's prepared to delay budget action for a month. The president is trying to get a handle on the flood of immigrants into this country. Before a joint congressional committee today, William French Smith outlined a new administration strategy. NPR's Bill Buesenberg was there.
The attorney general unveiled a package of sweeping proposals that he said were designed to gain control of refugee and immigration policy. Smith said current policies have failed to do that.
Last year, the number of immigrants legally and illegally entering the United States reached a total possibly greater than any year in our history, including the era of unrestricted immigration. We have lost control of our borders.
Included in the proposals are an experimental guest worker program to bring 50,000 Mexican laborers to the United States, $1,000 fines against employers who knowingly hire illegal aliens. However, there will be no tamper-proof Social Security card for employees to prove their legal status, increased border enforcement, and stepped-up Coast Guard authorization to intercept would-be illegal immigrants on the high seas. The Attorney General said the reform proposals will preserve the American tradition of accepting foreigners, but in an orderly fashion. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Washington.
In southeastern Iran, they're still counting bodies. The United Nations says the death toll from Tuesday's earthquake has risen to 8,000, with another 1,000 people buried in the rubble and 60,000 people injured. More than 250 demonstrators surrounded the French embassy in the Iranian capital today, demanding that France extradite the ousted Iranian president Bani Sadr. The deposed leader escaped to France yesterday, and now that the Paris government has granted him political asylum, Iran's hanging judge, the Ayatollah Khalkhali, has asked Parliament to decide the fate of the French embassy. Khalkhali also criticized the new Iranian president. More from the BBC's Peter Nettleship.
The Ayatollah said the people could not accept the negligence of President Rajai in allowing Mr. Bani Sadr to escape from the country. Ayatollah Khalkhali also criticized France, which gave Mr. Bani Sadr asylum on the condition that he does not engage in any political activity there. He said the French embassy in Tehran no longer serves any purpose and warned that if the government did not reach a decision on its fate, then the people would decide. A possible threat that the French embassy could be closed down or might even suffer the same fate as the American one did some 18 months ago. Mr. Bani Sadr has been Iran's most wanted man ever since the clergy-dominated Islamic Republican Party managed to oust him from office last month. And his presence outside the country, despite the restrictions of the French government, may well serve as another rallying point for Iran's increasing number of critics, both at home and in exile. Peter Nettleship, BBC, London.
Bani Sadr is ignoring French warnings to refrain from politics. In an interview with the Times of London today, the former Iranian president says an urgent way must be found to overthrow Ayatollah Khomeini. Northern Ireland hunger striker Kevin Lynch slipped into a coma today at the Mays prison after 69 days without food. Lynch and seven other inmates are threatening to starve themselves to death in pursuit of prison reform. Inmate Karen Doherty hasn't eaten for 70 days. He remains conscious but is barely able to speak. In the afterglow of their royal wedding, the Prince and Princess of Wales went fishing for salmon today on the first day of their honeymoon in the English countryside. With rod and reel in hand, Diana joined Charles at a secluded stretch of the River Test for a lesson in fly fishing. The newlyweds are spending the first part of their honeymoon at Broadlands, the elegant estate of the late Earl Mountbatten. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials up more than 7 points. I'm Richard Harris in Washington.
The president has all but completed his victory on the economic package, both budget cuts and tax cuts. But Democrats in both houses of Congress are trying to delay final passage in order to win last-minute concessions. NPR's Cokie Roberts has this report.
Yesterday, the House and Senate both passed the president's tax cut and finished reconciling the differences between their budget cuts packages in conference. But today, some Democrats are trying to make changes in the bills before they go to the president for his signature. On taxes, several Senate Democrats are threatening to filibuster the bill if it comes out of conference still loaded up with goodies for the oil companies. The senators are trying to force the conference committee's hand by making the most dire threat of all, keeping Congress in Washington through August. One senior Ways and Means Committee member today said that he thought the matter could be worked out in conference, but that it would probably take a week or so. Meanwhile, the $36 billion in budget cuts have already gone through the conference process. 58 subconferences involving over 250 members of Congress have spent the last few weeks working out differences between the House and Senate packages. Yesterday, the committee members signed the conference report in preparation for final passage by both houses and the president's signature. But for any bill to come to the floor of the House, it must first go to the Rules Committee. And today, Rules Committee Chairman Richard Boehling of Missouri refused to call his members to order. Boehling's concerned about the elimination of the minimum Social Security benefit called for by the budget cuts.
I still feel very strongly that we have to try to do the best we can to assure that no present recipients of any benefits are deprived of any benefits.
Even though the House overwhelmingly adopted a resolution calling for the restoration of benefits for current recipients, the conference committee refused to address the issue because members had agreed to take up only those questions where the two houses disagreed, and both the House and Senate had passed provisions eliminating the minimum Social Security benefit. Members of the budget committees thought that it would be more appropriate to pass a separate piece of legislation to restore the benefits, but Chairman Boehling is wary of such a course.
But I have watched over and over again people who I thought were able to make a commitment suddenly unable to live up to that commitment because of pressure that was understandable from other areas of Washington.
Boehling thinks that the language in the president's speech last Monday indicates that the White House intends to cut the benefits, and he wants to make sure that doesn't happen. The Senate leadership has countered Boehling's power play with one of their own. They're threatening to ignore the